Shrink Wrap Radio number 405, Developing DreamWorks Skills with Dr. Clara Hill.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Clara E. Hill, who is a psychology professor at the University of Maryland, a prolific researcher and author, and who will be a keynote presenter at the International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference in Berkeley, California, during June of 2014. For more background information on Dr. Hill, please go to our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Clara Hill, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you on the show. I especially wanted to speak with you in as much as you're going to be a keynote presenter at the upcoming International Association for the Study of Dreams conference this June in Berkeley, California. And I've been kind of advertising that on my website and trying to talk it up a bit. What's the topic of your presentation going to be?
I'm going to be talking about a body of research we've been doing on dream work in trying to determine if it makes any difference if you do dream work. We all know that dreams are fun and exciting and stimulating and intriguing, but the question is, does it make any difference if we actually work with dreams? So that my presentation will be a summary of about 30 studies that we've now done looking at dream work and its effectiveness.
Wow, that sounds really interesting, and maybe we'll be touching on some of that as we move through the interview. Maybe without giving too much away, that so much that listeners would not be motivated to attend, are there some of the highlights that you could mention right now of that research?
Yeah, I think the main take-home message that I would give is that it is effective to work with dreams, at least with the model that I've developed for working with dreams. I don't know so much about whether it would be effective to use any other models because I haven't tested them. So it is effective to work with dreams using my model. But what's very important is not everybody wants to work with dreams.
Yeah. everybody has that skill. And, I've been keeping it.
Skill. Mm-hmm. It's not just a skill. It's more some people don't remember their dreams. Some people don't value their dreams. And so you really have to remember and value your dreams before you're going to get much out of working with dreams.
Yes, yes. And I've been keeping a dream journal off and on for, probably 35 years or more. And but sometimes that question comes up for me. Is it really worth all this attention and time that I, at times I've put into it? So I sort of fade in and out of my enthusiasm. And so it's helpful to be in a dream group or to have just read a book about it or to go to a conference like the one where you're going to be presenting to kind of get my interest fired up again.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think there's I would say dream work is not the only way to learn about yourself. There's lots and lots of ways. I think psychotherapy in itself is very useful. I think dream work is a useful adjunct, and if you really like it, it's a great way to learn about yourself.
Yes, yes. So when did you first become interested in dreams?
Well, I've always been interested in dreams. I loved having my own dreams. But when I became interested in it professionally was more, it must have been 20, 25 years ago when I was teaching a theories of personality course. Uh-huh. And what I discovered was that to illustrate the different methods, the different approaches to psychotherapy, students loved it when we talked about dreams. So we would talk about a Freudian approach to dream interpretation. Clearly remember one kid raised his hand and said, I had this dream about a hot dog. and then you get into doing the Jungian approach to working with dreams and the Gestalt approach, and it brought the theories to life.
Yes.
So, that's when I became, in the back of my mind was, this is really a great method. And then I've been working in the field for, since I've gotten my PhD over 40 years. And I've been doing mostly psychotherapy research because I'm really dedicated to learning what makes psychotherapy effective. And at one point I was just kind of frustrated with kind of the methods we were using to study psychotherapy. And I kind of was, you know, I think all of us that do research kind of get into that point where we get stuck and have to kind of go someplace else. And at one point I started thinking, well, what else might I like to look at? And dreams came up real quickly for me. So that's when I became interested in dreams. And, at first just did dreams separately. And then as I got more into it, my interest in psychotherapy and dreams kind of converged. And so now I'm really interested in looking at dreams within the therapeutic context.
Well, those are both such important areas of research. You know, outcome research for psychotherapy is still, you know, a lot's been done, but a lot more still needs to be done. There's still lots of questions out there. And the same is true for dreams. So I understand the background for your professional interest in dreams. Can you say anything about your personal interest? Do you track your dreams in your own personal life, and have you found that to be useful?
Well, I would say I'm kind of like you are. There's sometimes I get really intensely into my dreams, and I record them, and I think about them. Certainly when I've been in therapy, I've presented my dreams in therapy, and we've worked on them. And then other times I kind of lose interest, and I might go for a couple of years without writing my dreams down.
Yeah,
so it kind of waxes and wanes.
Yeah.
You know, I think the big thing is when I have, you know, there's like a recurrent dream I'll have about flunking out of undergraduate school. You know, and that always brings to my awareness that, oh, something's going on.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'll pay attention to it when I have a particular dream or a dream that I can't quit thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to me, I don't, you know, most of the time I just enjoy my dreams. I just, you know, I love sleeping and dreaming, but I don't feel a need to analyze every single dream.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that gives us all permission to be a little bit more relaxed about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Now,
you know, I think the times when I've gotten really into, I've got to remember my dreams, I don't remember them. So I kind of have learned that I have to just kind of let them come, and when they're important, I'll remember them.
Yeah, I used to teach a class when I was still teaching at the university. I taught a class called Myth, Dream, and Symbol, and had students working in dream groups. And there were some who I think were just trying so hard that they couldn't remember the dreams because they were trying too hard.
Well, it's trying too hard, or, you know, they're just too scared, you know. But you know, you're in a dream group, and you don't know what you're going to find out. You don't know what you're going to reveal.
That's right.
But it can be very scary.
Yes, it can be. And I did everything I could to try to make people feel safe. But still, it can be. And they do end up revealing more than they thought they were going to when they signed up for the course.
But
most times it turned out okay.
I've done exactly the same thing where I have, you know, worked with dreams with undergraduates and graduate students. And, you know, for the most part, everything is great. We set up a safe environment. But you do learn things that maybe you're not ready to learn.
Yes.
So I think, you know, you have to make sure that people really know what they're getting into, and that you form a good empathic bond with them before you go there.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that your own approach, that you've been researching your own approach to dreams. So perhaps you can take us through your approach to working with dreams, which I believe you call cognitive experiential.
Right.
What can you tell us about that? What are the key assumptions and elements of your approach?
Yeah. Well, first let me say that, you know, the reason I developed my own approach was because when I started wanting to do research, you have to have an approach you're going to do research on. You have to have clear steps and clear guidance. And there's lots of great models out there, but they're very vague on what you actually do and when you do it and how you do it. And so it was very difficult to teach therapists how to do these vague things. So I discovered that I really had to try to, what I did was I kind of took what I liked best from the different approaches and kind of put them together in a sequence. And so, my big assumption underlying this model is that dreams are personal. And by that I mean you make up your own dreams, and so they reflect your own conscience. And so you can't go to a dream dictionary and look up what your dream means. So it's very, very important to say that the dreamer is the only one who can ever really understand the dream. I think you can have someone else help you. And so I think working with a therapist is really, really good. But the therapist is never going to know the meaning of the dream. It's not like you're going to go and get your dream interpreted, which is why we actually moved from calling it dream interpretation to dream work. Because dream interpretation made it sound like you go to this expert, and the expert says, here's what it means. Mm-hmm. And I just don't believe that. I believe so much that the dream is something that you have to come to figure out on your own. And, you know, we never know if that meaning is true.
Right. Wouldn't you think that a really experienced therapist who's worked with lots and lots of people and lots of dreams might at least have some good hypotheses?
Well, yeah, they might have some ideas, but I think the important thing is that they don't put their ideas on the client. The important thing is that they kind of work in this collaborative brainstorming process with the client to figure out the dream. So I think the one psychoanalytic therapist, Natterson, very, very experienced therapist, said the interpretation of the dream should come as a surprise to both the therapist and client. And I really love that statement because it's, if you know, you're working together to construct a meaning. Mm-hmm. And you know, you never know if the meaning is accurate or not. It's more, does it fit? Does it work? Can you go someplace with it? Can you use it? Is it meaningful to you?
Yes.
But accurate, well, we can never know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we shouldn't get hung up on that. So that's just a huge thing, is that the meaning of the dream is personal and that the therapist is not the expert who interprets the dream.
Okay. And in your approach, you emphasize exploration, insight, and action. So tell us a bit about each of these three and why they're important.
Okay, so exploration is basically client-centered, and in fact, the whole model is really a very client-centered model because it goes with this notion that the client is the only one who can really interpret the dream. So the idea is that the therapist is not an expert on the interpretation or an expert on the process. So the therapist can guide you kind of through some very gentle methods for getting to the meaning of the dream. So in exploration, what we do is we take a couple, you know, I originally started with, you take about 10 images and you explore them. And more recently, we've gotten to, you can only really get through 3 images or something. And because I really want people to explore each image in huge detail. It's kind of like blowing up the image, kind of trying to understand each piece of it, kind of trying to get into the image, experience it in the moment, kind of bring it to life, kind of look at all the associations around it, look at the feelings, the waking life triggers. And so this, each image becomes very crucial. We're trying to get, in a way, get the person back into the dream and experiencing it. And what's interesting is as you get into it and experience it, new details come up, new thoughts come up, and it brings up this, it's like reliving it. So that's really, really crucial. So that exploration is getting into the images, looking at them, experiencing them, and really trying to look at previous memories. I mean, the idea is that we're dreaming because we've got key issues that are coming up. You know, we're thinking about stuff. We never quit thinking. We're thinking during sleep, so we're dreaming about things that we're concerned about, worried about, anticipating. And the idea is that when we're dreaming, we connect our concerns with previous memories. And so what we want to do in exploration is connect all those images back to previous memories and associations. So we're trying to kind of get in the person's head. We're trying to illuminate what they're thinking about. So exploration, if you never did anything else, exploration would be the one thing you'd want to do with dreams. And again, the therapist here is guiding the client, just kind of talking to the person, trying to ask questions to help them get into the images and the feelings. And this is why we call it client-centered.
Yeah,
so that's exploration.
And so the next one is insight. And there's always seems like there's been a certain amount of debate about the importance of insight in therapy. Some therapies really hinge quite a bit on insight. And then there are critics who say, well, you know, insight doesn't necessarily lead to change. So tell us about insight.
Well, actually, in the dream models, there's more controversy over action. Most dream models include a component of insight. And I think it's because most people want to understand what their dream means. You know, if you come into a session or you know, when you think about a dream, what you say is, what does it mean?
Yeah.
So I think people are very motivated to figure out the meaning of the dream. So I think more of the controversy in the insight stage is, at what level do you interpret it? Does it mean something just about who you are? Does it mean something about waking life? Because most of us know that dreams are connected to waking life. Or does it mean mm-hmm. something about interpersonal dynamics? And it could mean something about any of those. A Freudian dream interpretation can be right. A Jungian dream interpretation can be right. You know, many, many ways of interpreting the dream can be right or helpful. I think,
yes.
As we mentioned earlier, it's not so much accuracy as helpfulness. So I think the real challenge for a therapist or somebody working with dreams is trying to figure out, you know, which direction to go with it, to try to understand it. And here the therapist is a little more active typically because they're trying to kind of often... We often use some of what Monty Ullman would talk about, like, if it were my dream, I might think it meant, how does that fit for you?
Mm-hmm.
So we might be a little more active in terms of trying to help the client figure it out, but never assuming that that's really what it means, which is why I love that notion, if it were mine, I might
yes.
think.
Yes, me too.
So that's kind of the insight stage, and typically we work at, again, I kind of alluded to this, but the first stage is kind of the stage of the experience itself, kind of like the phenomenologists say, it's an experience, you don't need to understand it as if it means something else, but maybe it just kind of says something about who you are. You can just understand the dream in terms of what it says about you. I mean, if you dream about murdering somebody, well, that says something about you, doesn't it? So it's kind of like who you are, or,
yeah.
you know, kind of like if you write a novel, you know, what the characters in the novel reflect something about you. And the same is true for a dream. You're dreaming it, so it reflects something about who you are as a person. So that's level one. Level two is waking life. So lots of times dreams do reflect, you know, what's going on in our waking life. Like we said, that people tend to dream about what is going on in the waking life, and there's a lot of research on that. That it's called the continuity hypothesis, that we dream about what we're thinking about. So dreams reflect waking life. So it's not a hard thing to guess that if I'm dreaming about flunking an undergraduate exam, maybe I'm anxious and something's going
right.
on in my waking life
yes.
that's causing me to be anxious.
Yes.
So then the deeper level is this interpersonality dynamics, where we might look at the dream bringing up issues from childhood, or the dream bringing up issues about kind of future, about meaning of life, existential issues, what's my purpose in life, where am I going, where am I headed?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of think of those as all on the deeper interpersonality level.
Uh-huh. And what about action? You said there's controversy around that.
Yeah, so like about, you know, if you look at dream models, about half of them go on to action and about half of them don't. And in my thinking, and in fact we did a study where we looked at if they had exploration and insight or exploration, insight, and action. And in fact, the only people who went on, and not the only people, but generally the people who did action only did it if the action was focused on in the dream work. So I think we showed fairly, at least I was convinced, that that action is an important stage. Because, you know, we all know lots of people who spend lots of time ruminating and thinking about why, but then they never do anything about it. So the action is, it's kind of, I mean, you can't move to action until you have some good insight. But the idea is that once you get some insight, now what are you going to do about it? So we kind of divide the action stage into first kind of thinking about action in terms of fantasy, if you will. So what I love to do is ask people, how would you change the dream if you could change it in any way you wanted? And the idea here is you created the dream. So at least in waking life, let's play with the idea of changing the dream. And that often loosens people up to think about changing. It's kind of a nice way of saying, well, if I could do my dream, here's what I would like to do with it. And then once they kind of figure out what how they would like to change the dream, we can ask them to bridge those changes to changes in their waking life. So you said you would like to not be so angry at your mother all the time. How could we work on that so that you wouldn't have to be so angry at your mother all the time? So it clearly comes from understanding what the dream is all about and then kind of using that understanding to try to figure out how to make changes in one's waking life.
I think sometimes people have an action step in which they ask the client to maybe do something symbolic of what they want to do in their life.
Exactly.
Is that something, do you think that's helpful, or is that sort of like phase one of action?
Well, it depends. What's really interesting is it depends on the dream and the dreamer. Some dreams are very concrete, and, you know, the person's, if I'm anxious about flunking my undergraduate class, I'm anxious about something in waking life, well, that leads clearly to some action about, well, what do you want to do about that anxiety? What, you know, what action plans can you take? So we might go with a very clear, okay, let's work on your anxiety. But some dreams are very metaphorical and whimsical, and you might get a whole bunch of insight out of it, but it might not lead to some direct action. So you might want to use a ritual to remember the dream and to remember what you learned about the dream. And so I consider that still in the action stage where, so for example, one person was trying to get over a relationship that was a problem. And so she took, made a little boat out of paper and set it on a river and let it float away, kind of symbolically allowing herself to give that up. Or another person was remembering conflicts with his mother, and he remembered her nose, and so he put a picture of his nose in the office, and whenever he would look at the nose, he would think about, you know, I want to try to remember the parts of her that I didn't like and the parts that I did like. So it's kind of it's not a behavior that you can change. It's something you learn about yourself that you want to work on more. So, yeah, it's another very good way of doing it.
Yeah. Now, you've mentioned some people and approaches that you've been influenced by. You mentioned Montague Ullman and If This Were My Dream approach, and you mentioned Gestalt and psychoanalytic and Jungian approaches. Are the dream theories or theorists that you disagree with or take issue with?
Not really so much. I mean, I would say my three-stage model, I think most of them fit someplace within that three-stage model. So, for example, Johnson talks his book on inner work really
fits
nicely. Yeah, one of my favorites. So it's not like I disagree with him. He's just heavier on the Gestalt part than I I included as one part. Jungian, I love Jung, but, you know, it's more in that insight stage. The phenomenology, I think, fits beautifully in the experiential part. So it's more like I don't disagree with any of them. I just think a lot of them aren't complete.
Uh-huh.
So even Freudian is great, and it has a really good place in associations and in the insight stage. But, you know, like it doesn't go on to action. And I would see mine as a very complete model and some of the other ones as, you know, kind of having a place there.
Yeah. This is a little bit of an aside from where I was going to go here, but I'm thinking about all this research that you've been doing both on therapy and on dreams, and I'm wondering what your stance is on the big emphasis that APA is putting on evidence-based approaches. where are you with that?
I don't like it.
See, that's kind of interesting from somebody who's doing a lot of research and working on evidence-based in a sense, but tell us about what you just said.
Well, I think it's very important to get an evidence base, and eventually maybe we'll have enough evidence that we can really guide practice really well, but I don't think we're there yet, and I think we make a mistake when we try to pretend we're there. So what happens is that, for example, cognitive behavior therapy is real easy to study. So we study it a lot. And then people say, well, that's the only one that's evidence-based. So that's the only one people can do. And so it becomes a political tool.
Yes.
And in fact, I personally believe that the most effective therapy is very long-term therapy, where you go into dreams and fantasies and long-term interpersonal patterns. It's very hard to study this stuff. And a lot of the changes aren't changes in symptomatology, but they're changes in the way we think about the world and the way we think about ourselves. And those are very difficult to study. So what happens is we say, well, if you can't prove it, it doesn't, it's a great statement. If you can't, something to the effect of, if you can't prove it, it doesn't exist.
Right.
You know, so we're going to throw out all these things that we know work just because we can't prove it.
Yeah, you know, or so if you can't if you can't quantify it, it doesn't exist.
Right.
There's often a variant of that as well.
Exactly. So I think we do ourselves and the community a huge disservice by forcing people to only use evidence-based practice. Like I said, in the long run, maybe we'll get there. But right now, I think we know, for example, one of the areas I do research in is looking at therapist training. Well, right now, we can't really show that training makes much of a difference. Like really? You know? We know it does. So, you know, we also know that our research methods are primitive for the most part. And just because we can't show it doesn't mean it isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think we all need to have a healthy skepticism about what we're learning. So on one hand, I think, of course, we need to do research and try to have an empirical basis, but we need not to always believe it so much.
Yeah, right. That's great. Now, I notice you've written a book on dream work in therapy, and you've been talking about therapy. I was going to ask you what you see as the main value of dream work in therapy. I think you've been speaking to that, but maybe is there anything more you'd want to say about that?
Yeah, we just actually, to be able to study dream work in therapy the way I wanted to, I ended up setting up a clinic about 6 years ago, and we've been studying dream work within the long-term psychotherapy context. And what's interesting is that it's a very small clinic, but out of 46 clients, only 23 brought in dreams. And of those 23, only 6 really talked about dreams in great detail. So I guess the important thing there is something I mentioned at the beginning, which is not everybody wants to work with dreams.
Mm-hmm.
This was even with all the therapists that had been trained. I had trained all of them in dream work. So, you know, they love dreams, but not all clients do.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, my guess is that most psychotherapists, not the ones you've trained, but just at large, probably do not give much attention to dreams. Is that your impression as well?
Absolutely. A lot of them will say, oh, I don't know what to do with them. So if somebody brings in a dream, they ignore it. And my position is, well, whatever you do, you should pay attention to it because you'd pay attention to anything else that the client brought in. So you pay attention to dreams too.
Yeah. And the ones who don't pay attention to them, what are they missing or losing out on?
Well, I mean, they can get to these things in another way. It's not like, I really want to be clear there, it's not like dreams are the only way to go. You can get to the same material, and I think this is why, actually, you know, some of the most basic research we have says that there's no difference between methods of psychotherapy. And I think the reason for that is because there's lots of roads to get to the same place. So you can get to deep psychological functioning by looking at dreams. You can get to it lots of other ways, too.
Sure.
So it's not like it's the magic bullet. It's not like you must bring in dreams like some Jungians. If you don't have a dream that week, you better go home because I'm not going to talk to you. Really, there are people like that.
Are there?
Yeah. But it is, I think it's a particularly nice way for some people to get to stuff that they haven't thought of. And I think what happens is lots of times people come into therapy kind of almost with an agenda. Here's what I want to do today. And they've done a lot of work and they've prepared themselves and they kind of have almost a script because they're worried about what the therapist is going to say. So they kind of get everything in line. Mm-hmm. And what happens with a dream is you do go places you're not expecting. And so what's nice is the therapist can, you know, as one of my students put it, kind of get in the back door. Not again that they have the interpretation, but they can kind of help the client kind of explore areas that they hadn't thought of as important.
Yeah, that's what I love about dreams is that they don't lie and they are an utterly spontaneous production.
Well, they are for some people. You know, in other words, not all dreams are alike. Some people have incredibly boring dreams. They might not get anything out of them. So for some people, they're not going to get much out of the dreams. It's not that dreams are lying, per se. It's just that they're not going to get much out of them. Uh-huh. But for some people, they could really get some really good things out of them.
Yeah, yeah. So it takes a certain kind of, maybe a certain kind of psychological mindedness to really get a lot out of them. Does that sound right?
Well, it does sound right. We've not been able to show that. I mean, I keep thinking psychological mindedness must be right, and I think there's some other ways that maybe we could measure it that we haven't tried, but the simple ways of getting at psychological mindedness don't seem to work.
Interesting.
But I think you're right. I think there's something about people really valuing their dreams, remembering their dreams, being willing to get involved in working with their dreams, because that's one thing we've consistently found is important, is this kind of client involvement. But not too obsessive about it either.
Mm-hmm. Are there any case examples that come to mind from your own work or the people that you supervise that you could share with us that would illustrate the value of dream work in psychotherapy?
No, I'm going to blank. I'll tell you one dream, and this is in another study we had where we were looking at therapist dreams about their clients. And so this is more on the therapist side, but the therapist had a dream that she was in a house that was on fire, and there's a knock on the door, and she opens the door, and her client's there, this strapping big guy, and she realizes that when she is aware of the dream, that the dream is telling her that she has some attraction to this client. And that really helped her kind of recognize what was going on. And we would call it countertransference, but, you know, the whole notion that she had some attraction to this client,
yeah,
was something she needed to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. That this was, she needed to be alert to it because she might act out on it in some way if she weren't aware of it. I mean, therapists often are attracted to their clients because we're attracted to people we're in close relationships with. But you don't want to act out on it. You want to figure out where that's coming from to both protect you and the client. So that was a case of a, you know, from the therapist side, how important it is for the therapist to be aware of what's going on. And the dreams really helped her understand at that point that something's going on that she needed to pay attention to.
Maybe we've already addressed this next question, which is, do you find that there are certain categories of patients or problems that are particularly well-suited for dream work?
I think it's this notion of the clients who have a really positive attitude towards dreams and who remember their dreams. Not a lot of dreams. They only need to remember one. So it's not like you need to write them down every night. I mean, you could work on one dream for years. So it's you know, not having tons, but really having this attitude that the dreams are something that I can get something out of. So that I think that's the key is being willing to kind of go there with a therapist. And on the other side, the people who probably aren't so good at working with dreams are people who don't want to remember, don't want to talk about them because they just don't value them. Or I think people who maybe have a bit of difficulty separating dreams and reality, you might not want to do too much dream stuff with them because they might have a hard time being able to cope with it. So yeah. Probably that's one kind of caveat is I would be careful there.
Yeah, that's something to ask you about.
There are therapists who work with schizophrenics in their dream, but I think unless you're really well prepared for that, I think it's probably something to avoid.
Yes. Now, I see that you've also written extensively on the development of skills for psychotherapy.
Right.
What specific skills do psychotherapists need to develop in order to become effective dream workers?
Good question. I think it's really important. I also have another book on helping skills, teaching therapists, especially beginning therapists, kind of the basics of therapy. Kind of, again, it's a very similar model to my dream model. But I think actually therapists need to learn from an early stage about how to listen to clients carefully. I think that's probably the most important thing, not interrupt. How to reflect feelings and how to ask good open-ended questions. Because as it turns out, the main things that are valuable in this dream model are kind of the probes for insight, like, can you tell me more about that image? What were you feeling at that moment? Are you a little anxious right now? So those kind of open questions and probes and reflections of feelings are probably the most crucial skills that therapists need. And to not be invested in having to, again, have the answer, but being able to kind of trust the process. So I do think it's actually very important for therapists to have some really basic training in the fundamental skills of how to do therapy before they try to do dream work.
Yeah, it could be kind of a trap for the therapist if they go into it believing that they're the expert and that they need to know the answer.
Right.
That really sets them up for possible disappointment.
Right. Well, and I think it's similar to clients or people going to a dream dictionary and they look up the dream images and they say, oh, an elephant means this. And so then they just say, oh, that's what my dream means. But there's not any sense of personal ownership. And I really think that when the client really comes to that understanding on their own, it's that aha moment. It's like, oh, I got it. That's what the dream means. It's so exciting. And I think they're much more likely to use that insight. So that's why it's so important for the client to come to the insight rather than the therapist telling them, because the therapist actually could have the correct interpretation, but the client would never have struggled to get there. So I think a huge part is the therapist helping the client struggle to get there and make it their own.
You co-authored a chapter on dreams and psychotherapy, and you reviewed several approaches there. What did you find? Are there some kind of broad outlines that you can share?
Well, what we were doing there is more kind of describing the different approaches. What's really important to note is that these approaches are really interesting and valuable, but they don't have any, for the most part, much evidence about how good they are. So I think therapists can certainly take these approaches and use them and think about them and incorporate different parts, but we really need more research looking at the components of those models that are effective. So, I really hope other people will get involved in doing more of this research on dream work.
Okay. And another topic that you research is clients and therapists dreaming about each other. You gave us an example of the therapist who had the fire dream. What in general have you found out in regard to client dreams about therapists or therapists' dreams about clients?
Yeah, this was really a fun study. What we did is, in this clinic that I mentioned, we had I think it was 13 therapists over a number of years, and the therapists kept a dream journal next to their bed every night and wrote down their dreams. And then when they had a dream about the client, they particularly noted that it was a dream about the client. And then we sent the dreams away to somebody else so that I wasn't looking and didn't know my therapist and their dreams about the clients. The clients, we did not ask them to keep a dream journal because we wanted the therapy to be as much like real psychotherapy as possible. So we didn't want them thinking that that the only thing we were interested in was dreams. But we did look very carefully at all the dreams that the clients brought into the clinic, and then at the end of therapy, we interviewed them about what dreams they had, why they brought them, or why they didn't bring them into therapy, and if any of the dreams were about the therapist. And what was very, very interesting was that 9 of the 13 therapists had dreams about their clients, but they didn't dream about all their clients. Okay, so there were some clients they dreamed about, but not others. And tended to be that and I'm not remembering offhand which clients they dreamed about, but it tended to be more the ones they were having more difficulties with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they were working in their sleep trying to figure out how to help these people.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that's what, I mean, struck us, that the therapists were very, very engaged. These are doctoral students who are in their third, fourth, fifth year of their doctoral training. And they really cared about these clients and really were working hard, even in their sleep, to figure out how to help them. On the other hand, the clients, only 2 out of, I think it was 57 clients, dreamed about their therapist. So dreaming about the therapist, although it happens, and there's certainly reports in the literature of it, in our sample, didn't happen that much. And the thing we thought was that the clients, if they're working hard, are working on their own issues, not working on their relationship with their therapist. So what they're going to be thinking about in their dreams is thinking about their interpersonal problems with other people or whatever brings them into therapy. And hopefully the therapist is just there to help facilitate their work rather than to be the one that becomes their whole object of attention. So that was fascinating to us, that it was more the therapist who dreamed about their clients than the clients who dreamed about the therapist.
Interesting. Now, I have the impression, and I don't know if this is still the case, but I have the impression that Freudians, at least in the old days, if a patient brought in a dream to the session, they would pretty much automatically look at that dream as a reflection about transference, as something about the relationship.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, I think that tends to be the psychoanalytic frame, is always you're looking at transference as relation to everything. And I think that's probably any dream or anything the person does in any kind of therapy is a reflection of their relationship. So, you know, there's always something the client is wanting by bringing in whatever they bring in. So certainly it's a reflection of their relationship, whether it's a dream or whatever else. But that doesn't automatically mean you go there as that's the direction you take to work with it. Sometimes it's better to work with what's going on in the client's waking life outside of therapy. Sometimes it's good to look at what's going on inside of therapy. But, I mean, both are important avenues for focusing.
And I have the impression that Jungians pay particular attention to the first dream that the client brings in, and that in some way that first dream may be a map of where that whole therapeutic relationship is going to go. what do you think about that?
Yeah, I've certainly heard that many times too. I haven't noticed that So I don't know that I would buy that so much.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it's a nice thing to say, but I just don't see any evidence of it.
Yeah.
I think any dream can be evidence of what's going on, and you know, I not necessarily.
Okay. Well, I mentioned that you're going to be a presenter at this upcoming International Association for the Study of Dreams conference, June 4th through June 8th, I believe. And I'm wondering, have you had an ongoing relationship with that organization? Have you been a member? Or is this a new thing?
No, I've been a member for years and years. I don't go every year. And the reason I don't is because the other conference that I love is usually at exactly the same time.
Oh, boy.
The other conference I go to is the Society for Psychotherapy Research, and so they're always battling in terms of, you know, which one becomes the most important. Fortunately, this year, the Society for Psychotherapy Research is meeting 2 weeks later in Copenhagen, so I can do both. but my overall, I would really say my overall interest is in the psychotherapy and how dreams fit into that. So the dreams are more something that, you know, how can you use them in therapy? So if I'm going to choose, I'm always going to choose the psychotherapy. But that said, I think the Association for the Study of Dreams was a wonderful conference. One of the really nice things about it is how interdisciplinary it is. So you're always going to learn something from some other field that you never even thought of.
Right. And the other thing that's very interesting about it is that it's not limited to professionals. So it's really wide open to anybody who wants to join and wants to be involved.
Right. So on one hand, that's absolutely great because you get lots of different perspectives. On the other hand, if you're really into research on dreams, dream work, you're not going to, you know, that's going to be a small piece of the organization. So there's not going to be a lot of people at any one time who are talking about this specific kind of research.
Yeah. So it's not as sexy as some of the other things that go on.
Right. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it's interdisciplinary and interprofessional, it covers a huge range of things.
Well, as we wind down, is there anything more that you'd like our listeners to know?
No, it's just been a lot of fun talking to you.
Well, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I certainly have. And so, Dr. Clara Hill, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Clara E. Hill. Personally, I find it gratifying to discover that there's someone out there with such a long and distinguished career as a dream researcher. Certainly, there are lots and lots of books out there about the subject of dreaming, and there's much of value that can be learned from them. At the same time, I think it behooves us to nail down as much as we can through scientific research. I think it's particularly interesting the way that Dr. Hill had to develop her own protocol for working with dreams so that she would have a more or less consistent set of data to work from for her research. In other words, she did her best to operationalize a consistent way of working with dreams that would later submit itself to rigorous examination. And inasmuch as she has been working away at this for around 30 years, those of you who are sufficiently interested can look for her research papers in the literature. In developing her standard protocol, I like the fact that she drew on what is pretty much the consensus about dream work these days, in a way that's informed by psychodynamic thinking, Jungian thought, and the Gestalt approach. And of course, I'm glad that she shares my bias in relation to the emphasis or overemphasis of the American Psychological Association and its stance on evidence-based psychotherapeutic approaches. We both seem to value the scientific enterprise and think it's a good idea. At the same time, we both recognize the danger of insisting that everything be evidence-based, becoming an overly narrow Procrustean bed. As we've noted in the past, double-blind studies, which are considered the gold standard of science, are very expensive to mount. Also, complex interpersonal transactions contain a multitude of subtle ingredients that may not lend themselves to experimental science. Science is not the only path to knowledge. Experience and observation are great teachers as well. Dr. Hill is a published author not only of scientific papers, but also books. If you decide to buy paper or Kindle versions of Dr. Clara E. Hill's books, as always, you can order them using the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Hannah Bogan, and I'm a speech-language pathologist at Communication Works in Oakland, California, so right in your neck of the woods. I recently discovered your podcast, and I am so incredibly thankful to have found them. I've actually devoured 9 in the last week. Although I'm a speech-language pathologist, I actually don't specialize in speech and language disorders as much as social cognitive and social regulation disorders. I work with preschoolers through young adults, helping them with executive functioning challenges and really any difficulties they might have that make it hard for them to accomplish their goals in a social context. I absolutely love your interviews and your podcasts, and I can't tell you how much they inform both my professional and personal lives. Thank you so, so much, Dr. Dave, for the commitment that you have to the broad field of psychology, and especially a huge thank you from those of us who seem to have a foot in psychology and a foot in some other related field. I'll definitely be becoming an ongoing contributor to your programming. Thanks, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Hannah Bogan from Oakland, California, for your enthusiasm, for becoming a financial contributor, and for encouraging others to help support the continuation of Shrink Wrap Radio by becoming financial supporters themselves. I'm extremely grateful to you, Hannah, and all those others of you who have chosen to help support Shrink Wrap Radio. If you're listening to this and you're not one of those who are a financial supporter, please won't you do so and get your name proudly on our honor roll on the website. You'll feel great, and I will feel ever so supported. There's now another brand new way for you to support the show through our new advertising affiliation with Audible.com. I imagine that many of you are already signed up with Audible.com. You like listening to podcasts, so it's very likely that you also listen to audiobooks. However, if you're not signed up with Audible.com, boy, do we ever have a deal for you. First, though, let me say that an affiliation with Audible.com makes perfect sense for this show because I've been a member for just about forever. I've been a huge supporter of their service, recommending it to friends for years, actually making myself a little bit obnoxious doing it. So I'm really happy to have the chance to generate a little extra income for the show by introducing the Audible.com service to any listeners who are not currently subscribed to it. At present, they have more than 150,000 titles covering both fiction and nonfiction categories in an incredible range of genres. There's quite a bit of content in psychology, too. For example, How About the Varieties of Religious Experience by William James? As you know, that's a topic we covered in a recent interview. One of the great things about Audible.com, too, is that you can listen to a 3-minute sample of any book you're interested in. That's a good way to make certain that you feel comfortable with the reader. That's always part of my own shopping experience there. Here's the offer. If you're not already a member of Audible.com, you can sign up using my link and choose any book you wish from their vast library for absolutely free. You have no obligation to continue your subscription, but I'm betting you probably will. So here's the information to get your free audiobook. You can either click on the little Audible.com banner link in our left-hand sidebar, or go directly to audibletrial.com/shrink. That's all there is to it. Unless you're a new listener, you're already aware that professionals can earn CE units, that is, continuing education units, just for listening to selected shrink wrap radio interviews. Most of them are available through the Zur Institute, where I think we have more than 100 CE units for shrink wrap radio. Well, I've recently added a new 6-unit course there titled Fundamentals of Positive Psychology. That's in addition to some other positive psychology classes that I put up some time back. Now, you'll find a link to this new course at the Zur Institute at the bottom of our show notes, not at the very bottom, but somewhere near the bottom, at the bottom of our show notes for this episode, or by going to the continuing education section on our store tab on our website. But wait, there's more. For the first time, we're able to offer CE units through our strategic partner, the Jung Platform. Now, currently, we have 3 new 5-unit courses there. One is called Perspectives on Addictions, another is called Working with Dreams, and another is called Unlocking Personal Wealth, Lessons from Positive Psychology. And as with all our CE courses, they're all about $10 a unit. So for this latest one, you can just go to jungplatform.com/courses, and you'll also find a link to these courses at the bottom of the show notes page for this and future episodes.
Hi, this is Dr. James Greenblatt, a psychiatrist, author, and integrative medicine pioneer, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, Dr. James Greenblatt will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now let me share a couple of recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Sister Susan in the UK. She writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm sending this via the Shrink Wrap Radio app." All right. From the Amazon UK. "I was enjoying catching up on a few of your recent episodes and found number 391 with Patricia Berry particularly interesting and helpful. On one of them, you reminded listeners about the Shrink Wrap Radio apps. I had previously read on your website that listeners outside the U.S. are not able to access the Android app from Amazon, so I thought I would check whether that might have changed. Sadly, it hadn't. For some reason, I thought I would try Amazon UK anyway, and there it was. I downloaded it straight away, and it is working well. It's great to have this easy access to your program, which it seems to me is getting better all the time. I particularly enjoy the way that interviewees who haven't known you previously warm to you through the course of the interview. It sometimes sounds as if they are a bit cool and distant at the beginning, but soon discover the depth of your interest and the breadth of your knowledge and really come alive to their subject. Thank you for all that you offer in making these wonderful, enjoyable, and informative programs. All good wishes, Susan." Well, thank you, Sister Susan, for letting us know that the Android app for Shrink Wrap Radio is available in the UK Amazon App Store. I would not have known that if you hadn't let me know. Others of you who are outside the U.S. might also want to check your local Amazon to see if our app is available to you. And, of course, our app is also available for all of you who have iOS mobile devices in the iTunes Store. You can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. I know many of you are using our app, and I've heard no complaints. Thanks again, Sister Susan, and it's good to know you're still out there listening, and maybe even more so now that you have a portable app. Next, we hear from David in New Zealand, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm emailing you to let you know how I discovered your podcast, because you often mention that you wonder how people discover your show. Well, I wish I had some great tale of how I did discover it, but my discovery was just through iTunes, as I was looking for a podcast to help me learn more about the way I think and to understand the way your mind works. I must say I certainly found that with your podcast. It's been and always is very interesting and enjoyable. So thank you very much. Kind regards, David from New Zealand." Well, thanks for introducing yourself, David, there in New Zealand. And it's true, I do wonder how people discover Shrink Wrap Radio. I wonder what search term you used when you were looking in iTunes. And with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 206-337-7170. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone, Android app, about which you can find full details again in the apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Dr. Clara E. Hill for sharing the fruits of her long career teaching about and researching dreams. As you heard, my next guest will be psychiatrist Dr. James Greenblatt, a pioneer of integrative medicine who, among other things, has used probiotics to treat a variety of emotional problems. I've long taken probiotics myself, but had no idea that they could be used psychotherapeutically. This should be interesting. So until then, I hope you'll join me. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.